Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. When the Democrats announced their initial $3.5 trillion Build Back Better plan last year, political groups and lobbyists representing some of the country's most powerful corporations immediately went to work. The most active, according to the Washington Post, was the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which fought against the bill's tax provisions. Like Big Pharma, which we discussed on yesterday's show, there are more tax lobbyists in D.C. than there are politicians. Thanks to their cozy relationship with politicians like Senator Kyrsten Sinema, the tax provision for wealthy investors and private equity fund managers was removed. The carried interest tax loophole allows wealthy executives to pay a 20% tax on profits rather than 37%. The change would have raised $14 billion over 10 years. But Senator Chuck Schumer said in order to get Sinema's vote, Democrats had no choice but to drop that provision. Over the past couple of weeks, private equity lobbyists were in constant touch with Sinema's office, according to the Wall Street Journal. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce said Sinema deserves credit for the bill's changes. So what is in the scaled-down bill? Well, the tax provisions will raise more than $700 billion in new revenue over the decade by closing corporate tax loopholes, empowering the IRS to enforce tax laws, taxing stock buybacks, and extending a limitation on deductions for business losses. Joining us to discuss the details and the tax system overall are two guests. Joe Hughes is a federal policy analyst with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, a nonprofit, nonpartisan tax policy organization. Joe's research focuses on progressive tax priorities to ensure corporations and the ultra-wealthy pay their fair share. Hi, Joe. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
Great to have you. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, editor, and co-founder of DCReport.org, a nonprofit news site that reports on what the president and Congress do, not what they say. David K. Johnston is a distinguished visiting lecturer at Syracuse University College of Law and the author of many bestsellers, including, and this one is very relevant to today's show, we've got The Big Cheat, How Donald Trump Fleeced America and Enriched Himself and His Family. David is also author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Hi, David. Welcome back. It's been a while.
Rose, good to be with you again.
Great to have you, David. I want to start off with you. And as you know, it's an hour show, so we have time. You have been a tax reporter with The New York Times. You have spent many, many years reporting on taxes. Yesterday, we talked about the drug price provisions of the bill, which I know you want to talk about that insulin $35 cap, and we'll discuss that later in the show. It took Democrats 30 years to change the law to allow Medicare to negotiate drug prices, in large part because Big Pharma has so many lobbyists in D.C., 1,587 to be exact, according to Open Secrets. There are more tax lobbyists in D.C. than politicians. So can you first talk about the power of this lobby and all of these people in D.C.?
Well, part of the problem in America, and the reason I think Donald Trump has so many ardent followers, is that we have a fairly large disconnect between the interests of most Americans and what goes on Capitol Hill. The reason for that, I believe, is that the post-Watergate campaign finance reforms, which I wrote about way back then, have backfired, and they have concentrated the influence of big lobbies, Wall Street, fossil fuels, pharma, weapons manufacturers, and given them much more influence than they had even, I mean, they had a lot before Watergate, but much more today. And the real constituencies, as we see with Senator Sinema of Arizona, are not the voters of your district or state, but they are the funders of your campaigns. So it's not the least bit surprising that important provisions are not in this bill on tax and on the spending side as well, because that's who matters. And one other thing, Rose, a number of years ago, tax analysts, who I wrote a column for several years after I left the New York Times, had a conference in Washington about corporate income taxes. And I turned to the Chamber of Commerce's number two guy at the table and said, all right, I have a proposal. New law, the corporate income tax is hereby repealed. What does the Chamber of Commerce think about that? Oh, well, I'd have to see the whole proposal. I said, I just gave you the proposal. It's a one-line change in the tax code. The corporate income tax is hereby repealed. And we spent several minutes parrying back and forth until I finally said, the reason you guys want to keep the corporate income tax is that many of your members at the Chamber of Commerce make a profit off the income tax, something I had documented 20 years earlier or 10 years earlier, and that all sorts of people wrote to the New York Times that I was crazy until Congress did a study, an 1,800-page study using their subpoena power, and showed that many corporations make a profit off the income corporate income tax, the kind of thing that Joe Hughes and the organization he's with, ITEP, have done a great job of trying to explain to voters.
Well, Joe, what about that? What would you add to talk about the power of these tax lobbyists? And then also, and we can talk about this later in the show, in 2021, September, Jesse Drucker and Danny Hackam at the New York Times had a piece called How Accounting Giants Craft Favorable Tax Rules from Inside Government. Lawyers from top accounting firms do brief stints in the Treasury Department with the expectation of big raises when they return. So can you also talk about the power of the lobby, the power of these accounting giants, and how they work to ensure that the tax system favors the ultra wealthy?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think this bill is great. I think it makes a lot of huge improvements on our corporate tax system. But I think myself and a lot of other tax analysts would agree that some of these are second best solutions. And a lot of that is because of the strength of the tax lobby, of the corporate lobby, that we weren't able to immediately pare back some of the provisions that corporations take advantage of to decrease their tax burden. Directly, like say the accelerated depreciation deduction, but instead we were able to generate some political interest enough to get the bill passed through the Senate to get this corporate minimum book tax that says, well, if corporations are reporting huge profits to their shareholders, then they shouldn't be paying nothing when it comes time to pay their taxes. So instead, they're going to have to pay at least 15% of whatever they're reporting to their shareholders. And even if that was able to be pared back by the lobbyists throughout the negotiations of this bill over the past week and a half.
And also for some context, before we dive into the details, David, can you remind us, since you have been writing about this for many, many years, just how the tax system has so drastically changed over the past, you know, many decades?
Well, the corporate income tax in the Eisenhower years, when the wages of most Americans were rising at a rapid clip, whereas they've been flat to negative for the last 50 years, corporations contributed about 9% of federal revenues. They're now down to somewhere in the order of 1%. Right after Trump's tax bill that only Republicans voted for, in which there were no hearings on, passed in 2017, that bill alone resulted in a one-third drop the next year in corporate income tax revenues. And I want to point out something very important about what Joe just said. The 15% minimum tax, which is one of many good provisions, there's a lot of good provisions toward reform in this bill. It isn't the whole loaf of bread, but it's a good segment of it. That applies to the profits reported by billion-dollar-plus companies as they report them to shareholders. Congress requires corporations to keep two sets of books. One set of books is for investors, reported to the Securities and Exchange Commission and published in by the companies and available from the government if they're publicly traded companies. The other is the books kept for the tax system, and they don't match. And in this case, what Congress is doing is saying, we're going to use the number you told the public was your profit, not the number you told the IRS, which is typically much smaller, and put a 15% minimum tax on what you told shareholders was your profit. That's, I think, a significant breakthrough to create this backstop by relying on what's called book profits rather than taxable profits.
Joe, can you also talk a little bit more about the 15% tax, because that's getting a lot of attention? What sort of context can you add to what David just said?
Yeah, so he's absolutely right. This tax is based on the book profits that corporations report to their shareholders. So right now they get the best of both worlds. They tell their shareholders that they were highly profitable, and then they turn around and they use a slew of deductions, of credits, convoluted tax scheming to move part of their profits to, say, Bermuda or the Cayman Islands, where they're not actually earning any of their profits. And they tell the IRS that they have very little taxable income. And of course, they still have a lot of money left over to pay their executive. So, look at Dish Network, for example, who came up in a report last year from Senator Elizabeth Warren's office. So in 2020, Dish Network, the satellite television provider, they made about $2.5 billion in profits. That's what they reported to shareholders. But when it came time to pay their taxes, they actually received money back from the government. And then they still paid out $100 million in executive compensation. And, you know, it's not just Dish. It's all sorts of companies. T-Mobile likewise reported $3.5 billion to shareholders, but then they received $7 million back on their taxes. And what's really important here, and what some of our critics will say when we bring this up, they'll say, well, they didn't do anything illegal. And that's exactly the point. They didn't do anything illegal, at least not that we know of directly. You know, this is legal tax avoidance, and that's a problem with our current tax laws. And that's what this minimum book tax starts to get at fixing. Now, the minimum book tax was pared back a little bit through the reconciliation process, and I think we'll find that a lot of these corporations will continue to pay less than 15%, but it makes huge steps forward to making sure that corporations are actually paying something to the country that has made them enormously successful.
You mentioned Dish and a couple others to add to your list. In 2021, you all reported that 55 of the largest corporations paid no federal corporate income taxes, despite enjoying major profits. Add Salesforce to the list. They avoided all federal income taxes on $2.6 billion of income. Nike didn't pay a dime of federal income tax on almost $2.9 billion of pre-tax income and enjoyed a $109 million tax rebate. You've got FedEx on there, Archer Daniels, Midland, so many corporations. So, Joe, can you talk about how this 15% tax will apply to these companies and when will it go into effect?
Yeah, so the tax will go into effect next year in 2023. And there's an important distinction to make there. You brought up our report that says it shows that 55 very profitable corporations paid no corporate income tax in 2020. Now, when we did that report, we weren't really thinking about this corporate minimum book tax. So we looked at things a little bit differently, and we looked at what taxes they were paying in the United States. And so this minimum book tax does look at their global profits. So that's another reason, or their global taxes, sorry. So that's another reason that some of these companies may not actually get hit with the minimum book tax. Take Nike, for example. They pay almost no taxes. Well, they get, I believe they get money back in the US in the years that we looked at. They do pay some taxes worldwide. You know, most of their manufacturing is based in Southeast Asia, and then they will have their intellectual property based in Bermuda or the Cayman Islands, where they claim to earn some insane profits, even though they have really no consumer base there. So we may not see companies like that actually paying the minimum book tax, but other companies like Apple, I think we can expect to pay the book tax. It's really hard to say right now because not all of the information that we need is publicly available, especially with the accelerated depreciation carve out that was added to the bill. But there was an estimate from the Joint Committee on Taxation. That's Congress's official revenue score. They looked at some of the companies that would be paying the bill, and they found that somewhere around 200 corporations would have paid the tax if it had been in effect in 2019. So, again, that analysis was also done before the changes were made. So, you know, I think we can expect to see 100 to 200 corporations year to year paying it, and likely many companies will pay it some years and not others.
Right. I was going to ask you about that, David. Mark Mazur, a former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Tax Policy at the Treasury Department, told the New York Times that the corporate minimum tax was, quote, not the best policy, and that accounting firms were probably combing through the legislation to determine how their clients could avoid this. He said that companies are going to find new ways to lower their bills. He said, quote, there are options to do things, and you can expect at least aggressive taxpayers to explore these options. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, this goes to something in economics known as second best. If you can't do the optimal thing and you do the second best thing, sometimes you can make things worse. It's an economic theory from the 1950s that's held up very well since then. Mark Mazur, who has always been a very straight shooter in my dealings with him, is exactly right. Every time Congress changes a tax law, you should think of it as a full employment act for tax accountants and for tax lawyers. And the way this is done and the wedge between book, or that is publicly reported profits, and profits as reported to the IRS, there are going to be opportunities here to game the system. No question about this. Now, as you know, Rose, I've mentioned in the past, I was writing a book about creating an entirely new federal tax system that every expert who's gone over it says would work. They don't believe politically it can be enacted because of all the people who profit off the tax system. But it would be much more efficient. And one of the things that I would do in my proposal, which I'm now back finishing that book after 7 years of focusing on Donald Trump, is replace the corporate income tax, which was very needed in 1909 when, you know, people got paid at the end of the week in a little paper envelope with dollar bills and coins in it. And we needed a corporate income tax to finance the government. I would replace that with just the rules from back then, which were corporations couldn't hold a lot of cash. You either paid your owners dividends, you paid your employees, including executives, more money, or you reinvested in the business. And this goes to, why do we have these artificial persons called corporations? They're very valuable and very important. We have them to encourage people to take risks, to invest, to grow the economy. What we are seeing happen, and has been going on for a long time, is a tax system that favors these corporations when they engage in behaviors that do not increase the country's wealth and make the country better off. And one of the things this bill does is it imposes a tiny tax, 1%, on companies that buy back their own stock. Mm-hmm. Now, companies do that because they issue stock options to their executives. The more stock that is out there, the more shares of stock, the less each stock has in value. So you give your executives 1 million shares 1 year, and you buy back 900,000 or 1,100,000. This is a way to transfer profits and wealth with no taxes to the people who hold on to their shares. I don't think a 1% tax on this is going to have much of an impact. And I wish we would go back to the pre-1981 rule, that is before Ronald Reagan. The rule said that stock buybacks were illegal. They're a way to manipulate the market and deceive shareholders. So this isn't a perfect bill, but as Joe pointed out, it's a big step in the right direction. But I would go way beyond that. I would repeal the corporate income tax and replace it with rules that say companies must either pay their workers more, pay their owners more, or most importantly, reinvest in the business. If they don't, they would then face a very heavy tax to make sure they do those things.
We'll talk more about the stock buyback provision in the bill, but David, can you also just talk to us about how the economy has really changed over the years and how you have so many people out there working in the service economy and barely making ends meet? And then you have the shareholder economy. And anytime we talk about profits and CEO pay, I mean, it's really head spinning how extremely wealthy people are right now. And if you look at just how much some of these massive corporations, just talking yesterday about Big Pharma, what their profits are every year, CEOs making over $20 million a year. So can you talk about that, just how the economy has really shifted over the years?
Sure. Well, we've had a complete breakdown of the social contract that arose with unions during the early part of the 20th century, and especially with the election of Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1932. There is no longer any sense of loyalty. Back 50 years ago, Delta Airlines announced that because the economy had slowed down, we had a recession in 73, 74, they had to lay off a lot of pilots and flight attendants and mechanics. He announced that he was taking a dollar a year pay until all of these people were rehired. Today, if the same thing happened, what you would probably read the next year is that they gave a bonus to the CEO, no longer called president, the CEO, for getting rid of workers and reducing their numbers. Unions in 1973 were at their peak. They represented more than one in three private sector workers. They now represent only about one in 16 private sector workers and have very little influence. And as Pope Francis has said, without unions, there is no economic justice. So once unions began to decline, something heavily pushed as part of the whole Reagan effort to kill the New Deal and move in a new direction. Reagan was very clear about what he intended in 1980, even if most news reports didn't make clear what he was saying. He said he wanted the owners of companies to enjoy the fruits of their business success. And what he meant by that is that they could take more money out of the business for themselves. So in 1980, no American owned a personal jumbo jet, a wide aisle jet as his personal airplane. Today, we have many people who own jets like that as their personal aircraft, and many more who use the company aircraft as a taxi service for their family and for their children to send them on vacation. And the company ends up picking up the bill for this, and that both the shareholders and the taxpayers get stuck with it. This is the result of structure. My 2003 book, Perfectly Legal, about our tax system. It's the book that won the Investigative Book of the Year Award. And John Kerry, on at least six occasions during his presidential campaign in 2004, walked into bookstores and made a show of buying my book. The New York Times wouldn't report that because they saw that as self-aggrandizing to the newspaper. So people don't know about it. It appeared in some provincial newspapers and small town TV stations. But that book documented this change that's taken place. And there's a chart in it that shows that if you took the average increase in income for the bottom 90% of Americans after a very long period of time, I think it was 50 years, and then put next to it the increase in income of the top 10th of 1% in America, you put the 90% as one inch, the other group's bar would have gone to the top of the page and continued for more than 62 feet. So all the gains are going at the top. We showed at DC Report not long ago that of all the pay increases granted in the year 2020 to every worker in America, all of this reported to the government, your W-2 forms, 82% rose went to workers who make over $1 million a year. Now, only one in 900 workers makes $1 million a year. Those one in 900 workers got 82% of all the pay raises in America. And that's what the system and the tax system is fundamentally doing. It is encouraging this upward redistribution of income and this mining of the mass of the American people to benefit an incredibly narrow group of people who then have lobbyists to go argue that, oh, if you tax us, we just won't do anything to grow the economy. We'll just cut back. We won't invest. We won't try to develop new drugs, which is a nonsense argument.
Right. You know, David, before we go to break, just quickly, the stats that you just laid out could easily be repeated, the big ones, in less than 30 seconds. Why aren't we hearing more about this and all of the stories we're hearing about inflation and how people are having a really tough time affording gas and food and just the basics?
Because most journalists accurately tell you what your sources are telling you. And only ITEP, for example, with a tiny budget of $1 million, less than $1 million a year until recently, and not much more than that now, produce this kind of work. And so the people that you talk to on Capitol Hill, the staff members who are there, the White House staff, those folks are telling a different story. And almost no reporters know how to use a spreadsheet. Very few of them know trust to do their own analysis. I always did my own analysis. And I know the business editor of the New York Times came to me one point and said, why are you doing all these spreadsheets? Just ask one of the accounting firms to do it for you. And I said, A, I think that would be unethical, but B, I wouldn't understand the numbers if I did that. We should all be doing our own analysis. So understand that most journalism is an accurate recounting of what people were told by their sources. It's not digging underneath, and it's certainly not understanding how the structure of government, the structure of tax law works.
David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, editor, and co-founder of DCReport.org, and author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Joe Hughes is a federal policy analyst with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, a nonpartisan tax policy organization. Today, we are talking about what is in the Democrats' bill that would affect taxes. Again, this passed last weekend in the Senate. Not one Republican voted for it. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will discuss a Capitol in Maine investigation exposing efforts to deny workers extra pay for extra work. Then we will discuss a new Frontline documentary called Ukraine, Life Under Russia's Attack. Also, because we spend every week talking about the climate crisis, I'm just getting some breaking news. There's new research out that shows the Arctic is warming 4 times faster than the rest of the planet. This was apparently unexpected to a number of scientists, so we will definitely do a show about that. And you can listen to our show on Tuesday, where we talked about the climate provisions of the Democrats' bill, and then yesterday we talked about the drug price provisions. Today we're talking about the tax changes. If you have any questions or comments about the overall tax system and what is in this bill, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, editor, and co-founder of DCReport.org. It's a great news website that reports on what the president and Congress do, not what they say. David is the author of many bestsellers, including Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Joe Hughes is a federal policy analyst with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, a nonpartisan tax policy organization. Joe, I want to ask you just a really simple question about taxes, because people like Grover Norquist and mostly Republicans have done a really good job of, you know, making people think that they too can become rich one day, and so therefore they don't want to pay any taxes. There are a lot of people that just hate taxes. I don't want the government, you know, taking my money and spending it. So can you just tell us why taxes are so important?
Yeah, sure. I mean, taxes are how we have nice things, right? They're how we have a society. And they're how corporations, many of whom get away with paying very low taxes, but how corporations like Apple or Bank of America have access to market, how they have an economy that makes them all their money, how they have employees who have education who can work for them and make a lot of money. And, you know, one of the things that I think that this bill, the Inflation Reduction Act, one of the great things about it is that it increases funding for the IRS by about $80 billion over the next 10 years, which will bring in another $200 billion, maybe more. You know, for the past decade, conservative lawmakers they've really slashed the budget, or at best, they've made sure that the IRS didn't have the budget for modernization or for replacing an aging workforce. And this bill reverses the course on that. And what's important about that is, like you said, everybody wants to be rich, but for the most part, it's only rich people who get to get away without paying their taxes. If you're an average person, like myself, if you're making wage or salary income, then your employer probably deducts a part of your salary each week to pay to the IRS. And then you have a W-2 that they submit to the Social Security Administration and the IRS. So it's very hard for a middle class or a low income person to get away without paying taxes. That's one of the luxuries that the rich and big corporations have.
We'll talk about the IRS in a minute. To Joe's point, though, David, about how average workers are paying more in income tax than people like Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk. In the case of Jeff Bezos, according to ProPublica, he says he makes somewhere around $80,000 a year. How could that be changed? Because this bill does not address any of that, right?
No, it does not. Very wealthy people borrow against their assets. I can borrow from a bank right now at 4% interest because I have very good credit. If you're Jeff Bezos, you can probably borrow at 2% if you're going to Goldman Sachs because they're holding and handling all your finances. Well, if you can borrow against assets far beyond any ability of you to spend, not a desire, an ability to spend, there's no way Jeff Bezos can spend his income, no matter how many jets and houses and girlfriends or whatever else he wants to finance. He can't spend the fortune he has. So why would he pay a 23% federal income tax on capital gains when instead he can borrow against his assets and pay 2%? And that's how very, very super wealthy people live. And then if you're in real estate, like Donald Trump, there are special rules that allow you, if you just work 15 hours a week, and there's no, of course, checking on your claim that you work 15 hours a week, to pay no income taxes. In fact, to get refunds back from the government that will make you better off. America really has two tax systems, separate and unequal. One is for people who work for wages, collect pensions or Social Security, and have their incomes tracked. And the other is for wealthy business owners, particularly those with international investments. And they live under a totally different system. There's almost no auditing going on of any serious kind. And so it's very important that we take the IRS, which is so stripped down right now, they're having trouble processing tax returns, taking in the money. We need to fund the IRS. And the example I would make is what Congress has done, pressed by Republicans, but sometimes helped by Democrats, is tell the tax police, that's what the IRS are, they are our federal tax police, stop investigating the murders, stop investigating the rapes, stop investigating the embezzlements, and go ferociously after tricycle thieves, because you are more likely to be audited if you are working class and get the earned income tax credit than if you are a business owner worth millions of dollars.
What explains this, David? Because the numbers show low income wage earners with less than 25,000 in total gross receipts were audited at a rate of 5 times as high as everyone else. What explains that?
Well, it was a deal Newt Gingrich made with Bill Clinton to increase audits of people who get the earned income tax credit, which Ronald Reagan called the best tax credit he'd ever seen, because you only get it if you work. And it encouraged poor people to work. And, you know, way back in 1755, in his first book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, Adam Smith wrote, and I'm paraphrasing, it seems to be part of the natural human condition to admire and even worship the wealthiest among us and to hold in disrepute those of mean condition meaning the poor. And there was no serious coverage of this issue at the time because the institutions who would have gone to reporters and said, you need to be writing about this, this, and this, the unions, the large religious social justice organizations, those have all dissipated in the last 40 years. And so we got this echo chamber of people representing the wealthy taking every position, and except for a few tiny organizations like ITEP, where Joe works, no one was standing up to them. And so we got this very distorted view of things. But don't ever underestimate the dislike of poor people in America by those who aren't poor. Not all of them, obviously, but by a large number of them, particularly those sent to Congress with campaign contributions from people who really don't like the poor. Hmm.
Joe, the anti-tax groups and Republicans are putting out a lot of misinformation about the IRS. You know, watch out, the IRS is coming for you. Can you tell us what the facts say that basically this additional money is going to allow the IRS to enforce the rules on people who make more than $400,000 a year? And as David points out, especially those who make millions of dollars a year. Can you talk about that, Joe?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, Congress, the Treasury Secretary, the IRS Commissioner, they've all been very clear that the purpose of this funding is not to increase audit rates on people making under $400,000 a year. And just beyond them stating that intention, it's kind of obvious they don't have much reason to focus on people making under $400,000 a year, because that's not where the tax gap lies. The tax gap is the difference between what is legally owed in taxes and what the IRS is actually able to collect. And it's estimated to be about $7 trillion over the next decade. And that's not coming from wage earners. That's not coming from people making less than $400,000 a year. That's coming from millionaires, billionaires, corporations. There's very little upside for the IRS to even try and focus on people making low wages. And just to put some of this stuff into perspective, right now at this moment, the IRS has fewer field examiners than they have at any point since World War II. And that's been a big boon to wealthy people and to corporations. Audits of the biggest corporations, corporations with more than $20 billion in assets, they've been cut in half since 2010. In 2010, about 98%, almost every corporation with more than $20 billion in assets would be audited. Now it's a little under half that. For wealthy people making $1 million to $5 million a year, the audit rate has fallen by nearly 70%. And David mentioned earlier the audit rates of people who collect the earned income tax credit, so low, middle-income people. This huge cut in the IRS budget, it's led to a little bit of a decrease in audit rates for those people, but nothing like the decrease in audit rates for corporations and for wealthy people.
Rose, if I can build on that for a second.
Please.
Corporate auditors, the very top paid corporate auditors, make around $160,000 a year, and they bring in $20 million a year. Anybody who owns a business who had salespeople bringing in that kind of money, $20 million for $160,000 salary, would be hiring more of them. But under orders from Congress, particularly during the previous administration, we have been cutting those auditors, and we've also been ordering them to do what is known by some folks at the service as audit light, L-I-T-E, like that terrible stuff called light beer. Grover Norquist and the people like him are right now out selling a big lie. They're saying that this plan actually raises taxes on people who make under $400,000 a year. How do they achieve that? Well, when the Joint Committee on Taxation, the official scorekeepers who Joe mentioned earlier, did their analysis, they attribute some corporate profits to people at every income level. And so if corporate profits, corporations pay more tax under that economic system analysis, then you can say that people under $400,000 will pay no more tax. You won't on your individual income tax pay any more. And by the way, people at $100,000 to $200,000 of income, they get 3% of their income from dividends, 3%. So, you know, you might, in effect, indirectly pay 50 cents a year or $2 a year more in tax. It's bupkis. It's irrelevant. But they on Fox Business News and elsewhere, they are hitting this really hard that Biden broke his promise that nobody under 400,000 would see a tax increase. Your personal tax return won't be changed one bit. And unless you're part of the minority of people who directly own stocks, that's less, it's about one in three Americans, you won't be affected at all by this. But it's part of the way the tax lobby and its allies in the press mislead people and confuse people.
Also, David, when you look at what the IRS is facing, Catherine Rampell visited an IRS in, I believe it was, Austin, Texas. And there's this photo of the cafeteria that is just full of these old folders, full of paper, the cafeteria. And she points out that the IRS has a backlog of 10 million unprocessed returns as of July 29th. And like so many other issues around in this country, for example, our employment department here in California is using antiquated technology. I mean, in a state like California, you can have a driverless car, but your employment office is still using old technology. Same thing applies to the IRS.
So, yes, many of the people the IRS would add are not auditors or criminal agents. Almost all of them are people like clerks, data processors, computer wonks, people who do computer coding. Back in 1998, when the Republicans held these hearings that claimed that there were these horrible abuses by IRS agents doing terrible things to business, which the Wall Street Journal, tax analysts, myself, and some others showed that in every case, these people lied under oath. Their stories had nothing to do with what the record actually showed, because they, of course, knew the IRS couldn't respond because Congress doesn't allow the IRS to respond under a law called 6103. They promised that they were going to give the IRS modern computer systems, which could be used to identify the people who should be audited to simplify the system. Congress has never given them the money to do so. They've given them dribs and drabs of money, but never what's actually needed. And who benefits from this? Well, one of the great lessons Grover Nerquist, who I spent a couple of hours interviewing recently, has learned is if you can gum up the tax system and make it so that they have rooms full of paper that they can't process because there aren't enough people, people get even angrier at the tax system. And that's what he wants.
Right.
Without taxes, there is no America. There is no freedom. In fact, the reason we live under the Constitution of the United States is in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1. The previous government of the United States under the Articles of Confederation failed because it had no power to tax and no power to regulate business. And we overthrew that government and created this wonderful, not perfect, but much wonderful system that has benefited us for more than 200 years, so we could tax ourselves. We don't teach that in school. My law students, they're like, what? You know, they can't believe it until they actually look at the records and do some reading and discover we created this country so we could tax ourselves.
Hmm. Any other insights from Grover Nerquist, David, about what their plans are in the coming years?
Well, let me go off of something I learned from interviewing Grover. One of the reasons Build Back Better, which would have dramatically improved the economy in this country and made us better off, failed, is the Democrats don't know how to market. Joe Biden keeps saying, or did say till he abandoned this, I want to spend $3.5 trillion. Well, first of all, can you imagine what $3.5 trillion is? I can't, and I work with these numbers every day. I wrote a piece at DC Report that said, Would you invest $3 a day so that you and your progeny will be wealthier and you'll have a nicer life? And of course, we all would agree to that. Well, that's the cost of Build Back Better, less than $3 a day, less than a cup of coffee a day. is what $3.5 trillion over 10 years comes to. Many news reports don't point out that these plans are 10-year spending projections or 10-year income projections, not immediate. And for one day after I wrote that column, Joe Biden walked out and talked about invest. And the very next day, he went back to spend. And if we're going to have real change, the Democrats have to learn how to talk to people in a way that makes sense to them. I don't want the government to be spending more money. And I can afford to pay more taxes, but I don't want the government to spend more money. I want to have the smallest efficient government that we can have. And the idea of $3.5 trillion of spending, that's scary to people. No, it's $3.5 trillion investment in the future of America, in fewer potholes, more educated workforce, not paying $1,000 a month for insulin or dying early because you can't buy the insulin at that price. And that's what his original proposal would have done. But you got to learn marketing. Look at how Donald Trump marketed himself. Look at how Grover Norquist does it. And that's what the Democrats have got to learn if they're going to get us real change in our tax system.
It's a great point, David. And we had you on talking about the $3 number because the media spent more time talking about how scary this number was than what was actually in the bill. I should say many, many in the media.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can we also talk about, before we end, I have to say the Wall Street Journal had a really interesting piece about just the role that Kyrsten Sinema played in all of this. Well, before we talk about the Journal, CNN had a piece about Danny Seaton, the president of the Arizona Chamber of Commerce, who said in a private call with Sinema about the 15% minimum tax, she asked, is this written in a way that is bad? So there's that. And then the Journal had a really interesting story. And Joe, maybe you can just talk about this. I think it's just important for us to know what's going on behind the scenes around taxes. Back in the day when a lot of people really didn't even know what private equity firms were, there were not many lobbyists out there. But then in 2007, Victor Fleischer, a professor at UCLA, wrote a paper criticizing it as a loophole in the tax code. And of course, that caught the eye of lawmakers. At the time, private equity did not have a trade association, but then firms like Blackstone, Carlyle, and Apollo Global branded together with Ken Melman, George W. Bush's 2004 reelection campaign chair, and they started a lobby group for private equity. And back in the day, they spent maybe $15 million. That was in 2004. Now they're spending $222 million on lobbying. So, Joe, I think it's important just to talk about this to let people know what is actually going on in the halls of power and the fact that they have been in touch with Kyrsten Sinema on a daily basis around these changes.
Yeah, sure. I won't speculate as to what Kyrsten Sinema's particular motivations are when it comes to private equity, but it's very clear that she is highly sympathetic to private equity. And that came up twice in the negotiation of this bill. First, the original Schumer-Manchin agreement that came out before the bill went to the Senate floor for a vote, it included this small but good fix of a loophole called the carry interest loophole. And so just some background, basically what that loophole is it allows managers of private equity funds or hedge funds, well, they typically take a share of the profits around 20% as their management fee. And, you know, a normal person would probably think of this as compensation, like a salary or a wage. If you ask me to sell your car for you and I say, sure, I'll do that, but I'll take 20% of whatever profits I make. I'm basically taking a wage from you. But the IRS has allowed private equity managers to treat this as capital gains instead, which are taxed at a much lower rate than earned income. And so this provision, before the bill even hit the Senate floor, was removed at the request of Senator Sinema. And it was replaced with the stock buyback tax, which I think was ultimately a good trade because the stock buyback tax really raises a lot more revenue. But it's, you know, why couldn't we have both? It's sort of mind-boggling that anybody felt the need to go to bat for private equity fund managers in this bill, especially, you know, it was a small revenue raiser. And then this came up again at the 11th hour, right, when it looked like this bill was about to pass the Senate. And then all of a sudden it looked like it might not pass the Senate, or if it did pass the Senate, that it might not pass the House, because Republican Senator John Thune introduced this amendment that created another carve out in the corporate minimum tax for private equity funds that are part of a larger conglomerate that would have been subject to the corporate minimum tax. And so they carved this out and said that private equity funds wouldn't be subject to the corporate minimum tax. And the reasoning was that this was supposed to protect some small businesses, but it's not been clear to me so far who these small businesses are that are part of a billion-dollar private equity firm. This could be an issue going forward, and I might expect this to be repeated, that for whatever reason, and I won't speculate to the motivations again, Senator Sinema is very sympathetic to the views of the private equity industry.
David, in our remaining minute, what can people do to change the tax code in this country?
Well, vote, and vote for those people. Ask your senator or your congressperson, you know, what's your position here on taxes? Take a look at the votes. They're all public record. They're not hard to find on the internet. And ask especially about things that make the economy less efficient. The way we do pharma drugs, we didn't allow the government to negotiate for drug prices. I mean, I just negotiated for a new roof job. I mean, who doesn't negotiate prices when they can be? Things like that. And if your congressperson voted in favor of, you know, no bid contracts for supplying the government or Medicare with drugs, you know, vote that person out and get somebody who will look for how to make the economy more efficient. It's unpleasant to think about taxes, but taxes are central to our liberties and to our economy.
David K. Johnston is co-founder of DCReport.org. Joe Hughes is federal policy analyst with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. David and Joe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.